You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. In 2014, northeastern Syria might have been the last place you would expect to find a revolution centered on women's rights. But that year, an all-female militia faced off against ISIS in a little town few had heard of called Kobani. By then, the Islamic State had swept across large swaths of the country, taking town after town and spreading terror as the civil war burned all around it. From that unlikely showdown in Kobani emerged a fighting force that would wage war against ISIS across northern Syria alongside the United States. In the process, these women would spread their own political vision, determined to make women's equality a reality by fighting house by house, street by street, city by city, against the men who bought and sold women. Their harrowing tale is the subject of a new book by acclaimed journalist and author Gail Samak Limone, titled The Daughters of Kobani, A Story of Rebellion, Courage, and Justice. And today, Gail joins me on the podcast to discuss how the female fighters of Kobani helped to deliver the first blow to the up-to-then unstoppable forces of the Islamic State, and how that victory convinced the U.S. that it had a reliable partner on the ground in Syria. She also shares the individual stories of some of the remarkably brave women she encountered, including some who rose to command both women and men in combat, and some who were forced to marry ISIS fighters, survived unspeakable brutality, and then went on to defeat ISIS on the battlefield. She reveals how the women of the Syrian Democratic Forces are now working to establish equality for women in Syrian society, and how they're spreading their message and fighting institutionalized misogyny in one of the most hostile regions for women in the world. Plus, how ISIS members reacted when they realized they were getting their butts kicked by a bunch of badass women. Coming up with Gail Limone in just a moment. Gail Samak Limone is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Ashley's War and The Dressmaker of Kirkana, who has been referred to as the most unstoppable woman in the world. An adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, Gail regularly appears on CNN, PBS, MSNBC, and NPR, and has spoken on national security topics at the Aspen Security Forum, the Clinton Global Initiative, and TED. Now she's out with a new book called The Daughters of Kobani, A Story of Rebellion, Courage, and Justice. Gail, welcome to the podcast.
Great to join you.
Well, Gail, man, what an inspiring tale this is. Your book tells the true story of the young women of the YPJ, or the Women's Protection Unit, within the Syrian Democratic Forces, who played a crucial role in defeating the Islamic State and have now, I guess, gone on beyond the battlefield to really change the role of women in Syrian society. How did you first become aware of this amazing story?
It is an amazing story. And what happened was one of the women who had been in Ashley's War, a soldier in U.S. Special Operations, called me and said, Gail, you have to come to Syria. You have to see what's happening here. there are women leading on the battlefield, and they're not just leading women, but they're leading men. And then she said, you know, the thing that's amazing is that they have both the respect of the men that they fight alongside and U.S. Special Operations Forces, who are just, you know, enormously impressed with them as warriors. And she said, you know, I've never seen anything like it. And you have to come tell the story.
I think back, I think I've seen occasional coverage of the women of the YPJ, but it's been pretty rare, I think. I would think that this would be a real headline grabber. So why haven't we heard more about their story?
Well, just think about the last several years. You know, we have so much focus on what's happening here at home, politically, what's happening in the economy. And listen, I mean, I grew up in a community of single moms. And first and foremost, you have to take care of your family and you got to make sure everybody is taken care of by you. But I thought, you know, how extraordinary this story is of women who fought ISIS, not just for their region, but really for the United States. Right. If you think back to 2014, right, at that point, ISIS was storming across Iraq into Syria, taking town after town. Nobody had managed to hand them even one loss. And then you come to this town of Kobani and you have this kind of, you know, David versus Goliath story that gets captured by cameras of ISIS that's been on a tear, making it slick videos and propaganda. And then this fighting force of largely Syrian Kurds with women leading in battle and women's equality right at the center. And you have this showdown between the men who buy and sell women, a central part of their ideology, right up against a fighting force who had women's emancipation and women's rights right at the heart of who they were.
In 2014, when these women began fighting ISIS, the Islamic State was in a very different situation than it is today. There was a very real danger that ISIS might overrun the whole Middle East. So I wonder, Gail, if you could sort of set the scene for us. Back then, just how powerful was the Islamic State in terms of the number of fighters, arms, wealth, and also the land that they controlled at that point?
This point, 2014, ISIS is glittery and unstoppable. In the view of US officials, they're watching them take the town of Mosul, which is a sizable town in Iraq. And US officials are step back and they say, holy cow, wait a minute, who is going to stop these people? And as you know, right, the ghost of the Iraq war hung over every decision made on Syria. So when putting US forces on the ground was not an option. And so the question became, who's going to be the Goldilocks, right? Who's going to fight the Islamic State and die fighting for the Islamic State, fighting against the Islamic State, but be willing to stop short of removing Assad? Because at that point, 2014, President Obama is in power. Neither he nor anybody he is serving with has an appetite for regime change in the Middle East. And the people who are bringing the fight to ISIS turn out to be this group of Syrian Kurds that nobody had ever heard of, you know, making this kind of very dramatic stand captured by cameras and broadcast onto CNN in this little town of Kobani that very few also had ever heard of before this moment. And the question was, who was going to go up against ISIS, which had fighters coming from all over the world? You know, it becomes kind of this Club Med for extremists, you know, come to ISIS territory and have your purpose fulfilled. And then they come up against this fighting force that truly believed that they couldn't be free until women were free. And the Americans are paying attention and say, hold, wait, this might be a shot for us to have a partner on the ground who's willing to go room by room against the men of ISIS and let the Americans help from the air.
Well, yeah, I want to talk about that moment, the Battle of Kobani, which really ends up being sort of the inflection point for many of these female fighters. Kobani is not a major city. It's sort of, I don't want to call it a nothing town, but very few people have ever heard of it. And yet what took place there really represented a turning point in the war against the Islamic State. What was the strategic importance of Kobani?
It's such a great point, right? Because even doing the research for the book, people would say, well, that country bumpkin town was never going to be the one that stopped ISIS. Really, that was their view. And that was ISIS's view too, right? Like nobody in that town is going to give us a hard time, right? If we already took all these big cities, who is this, you know, who is this kind of no-name force? And the women we meet are absolutely determined that ISIS will remember who they are, even down to the last street. They said, you know, we will never stand for a world in which the Islamic State and its values and its treatment of women stands ever. And if we give our last breath for it,
we will have done something that mattered. And so it becomes this very dramatic showdown. And the Americans care because if they take Kobani, now they have a whole bunch of territory that makes it easy to cross between Iraq and Syria. And for the US, what they were deeply worried about was the exporting of terrorism. Not bad enough that they were going to cause harm and damage to small people, to little boys, to little girls, to adults, but that they were going to plan attacks from that territory against the region, against Europe, and certainly against the United States.
How did the women of Kobani actually come to take up arms against ISIS? Was it just kind of an all hands on deck situation, or how did that happen?
So, in Syrian civil war starts, and the women we meet in this book, Rojda, Nawruz, Zarin, they had already kind of just gotten together with other people from their area and said, we'll protect our neighborhoods. So imagine, right? It's like in your neighborhood, if something's coming, you know, you get together with your neighbors and figure out who's going to do what and how you take care of your own. And that was really how this started. They never thought they would be on the global stage backed by the United States, right? With this showdown on camera against ISIS ever. But this, what started as a very peaceful democratic protest in 2011, morphs into this battle that extremists use as their playground. And so they are just then, these women are saying, no way, we're not having men who buy and sell women. We're not having extremists come into our neighborhood. So they take up arms. And the fight that went from kind of protecting your town goes to protecting your whole area from the values that these men are trying to bring to it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting how so many times in times of war and chaos, there are often greater opportunities for marginalized groups, whether it's, you know, Rosie the Riveter in World War II or the Daughters of Kobani during the Syrian Civil War.
I couldn't agree more. And actually, all three books I've written now and had the privilege of sharing with readers are about this. But think about this, you know, Rojda was going to be a pharmacist, and Nawruz is going to maybe be a doctor or a lawyer. You know, none of these were all pretty ordinary people who get thrust into extraordinary circumstances for their people. And then they end up doing the world's work, fighting ISIS so that you and I didn't have to, quite honestly, right? And I think that was what their journey from kind of, you know, being people like you and I would have coffee with on a regular basis to having, you know, seeing, you know, 30 women with fatigues and flowers in their hair and Timex watches and AK-47s going off to fight the Islamic State is one I wanted readers to really experience for themselves.
I mean, these women are hardcore badasses, I have to say. I think you kind of mentioned this earlier, but it's one thing, you know, when you're defending your own hometown and there's a direct existential threat to you and your family. But as you mentioned, many of these women after the Battle of Kobani went on to continue fighting ISIS elsewhere. Did you talk to them about what led them to want to continue to put themselves in harm's way and be part of the larger effort to push back ISIS?
So, absolutely. And originally, they were trying to protect the Kurdish communities, right? So all they wanted was the ability to name their babies, what they wanted to publish in their own language, to celebrate their holidays, to play their music without the government telling them they couldn't. Then come the extremists of ISIS and they win in Kobani. You know, this David versus Goliath story happens where David is also a woman and wins, right? And so they realize that it's important, not just for them and not just for women in their towns, but for women across the region. And they understand by then what ISIS is doing to women, that ISIS truly is buying and selling women, and that violence against women is at the heart of what the Islamic State is and was. And they said, no way, right? Like, the Americans asked them, the US officials say to them, you've proven yourself here. How about we try to keep going? And for them, you know, anything they could do to stop ISIS exporting its brand of barbarism was a win.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. I mean, it's hard to imagine a more brutally misogynistic group than the men of ISIS. And yet these women took them head on. For context, give us a sense of ISIS's attitude toward women and how women are treated by these thugs.
You know, so the tragedy of ISIS in Sinjar is one that I think truly people who study crimes against humanity will be studying for generations. They go in the summer of 2014, fresh from all these victories, these towns that they have been taking, this fighting force, and they come to the town of Sinjar. They separate the men and the women of the Yazidi community. They kill the men and they take the women. And they truly set up a trade where they are buying and selling girls and women.
Wow.
And the world is watching on YouTube. The world is watching on Telegram, right? I mean, this is all happening in real time. And for Rojda and for Nowruz, there's a moment actually in the Battle of Kobani where Nowruz, who leads, whose own mother had never been educated, who was illiterate, who had always told her as a girl, make sure your life is different than mine. Wow. She is now leading this women's protection force, and she gets on the radio. They're low on food, they're low on weapons, they're low on ammunition, they're low on just about everything you would need to fight ISIS, but they have will and they have spirit. And she gets on the radio and says, you saw what happened in Sinjar. You saw what they do to women. Show them your value. Make sure they know who you are and what you stand for.
Wow.
Even if this is the end.
Yeah, I recall that at least one of the women that you profiled had actually been forced by her brother into marrying an ISIS fighter and apparently survived to return home and fight ISIS on the battlefield. Can you tell us a little about her? And are there a lot of stories like hers?
You know, so this was at the end of this story, I introduced readers to some of the young women from Arab communities who joined the Women's Protection Force. And this young woman was sitting in this room, and all these women had stories. I could have been there for years, honestly, just interviewing them and asking them their stories about life under ISIS. And this one young woman, I just happened to say, can you tell me your story? And as it turns out, her brother joined ISIS from the town of Raqqa, which becomes the ISIS capital, right? Where they plan lots of attacks against the rest of the world, and forces her, even when she tries to escape, to go back to this husband. She ends up being brutalized by him and by a number of members of the Islamic State, and comes back home and joins the Women's Protection Force. And honestly, I'm sitting there listening to her, and the only sound is just sunflower seeds from Rojda, who is her commander and knows the story well. Her sunflower seeds hitting the metal bowl beneath her. And this woman says to me, I joined because I would not stand for this. Why should anybody have the right to do this to me or any other woman? And this was my part of standing against them.
Wow. I mean, that is just an amazing amount of bravery. I mean, if I had been through what she had been through, I would want to get as far away from ISIS as possible. I mean,
you and I share that. That was exactly why I asked the incredible question, because I felt the same thing.
Yeah. So if these women had been captured by ISIS in battle, it's pretty much a given that they would have been raped, killed, or both, right?
And that was actually, there's a story in the beginning of the book about Irene Merkan, who is at the very end of the battle for Kobani. Things are looking pretty bad for them. This is maybe 3/4 of the way in the fight. And at that point, even the U.S. thinks Kobani is going to fall. No one thinks that they're actually going to be able to pull off this win against the Islamic State and to defeat ISIS for the first time. And Irene Merkan, this young woman, basically gets close to an ISIS tank and blows herself up.
Wow.
So that she knew she was going to be killed. At least she would take some of them with her and make it harder for them to win.
Oh my God.
And wow. None of this is, hero. You know, I just wanted readers to see those moments and to experience what people were willing to do to stop these men.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Now, one of the people who you spoke to on the U.S. side was actually Brett McGurk, who served as the special envoy to the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS. What did he say about the significance of the Battle of Kobani and the women who fought in terms of how that influenced America's own role in Syria?
And, you know, and I really want readers to kind of enter that moment for the U.S. officials. There's Brett McGurk. There's folks from the U.S. military. There are all these people trying to figure out who is going to fight ISIS on the ground for and with America and the world. And so they're watching this go on, and they have this discussion with the folks who are on the ground and say, you know, maybe we can extend this partnership. Maybe we take this battlefield victory and we go on and on and on from here and find a way to end the Islamic State's territorial hold. And for them, this was America's last and pretty much only hope in the fight to stop ISIS. And these women and the men that they served with, they had 10,000 losses in their fight to stop ISIS. Wow. Right. And, you know, about 10% of that was women.
I think you compare that to 10 losses on the U.S. side, right? Wow.
That's right. That's and every stark. Gold Star family is a tragedy.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. But if you think about a partner that did everything the U.S. asked, not just on behalf of the U.S., but on behalf of the world. Imagine a world now where ISIS still had territory from which it could be attacking. And the fact that it was women who brought the fight to them, I think, was just for them in many ways divine justice.
Right, right. And it's amazing that they sign up for this over and over again, as many times as the U.S. has thrown the Kurds under the bus.
You know, truly, I think this is about America's national security. When you think about who has done the fighting for the U.S. In this fight, it is these people. And I think one of the things that struck me was I asked Nowruz once why they did it. This was after so much had happened that was very difficult with the U.S. And she said, we do it for the next generation. We do it so girls and boys born after this won't know this world.
You also spoke with some of the U.S. forces who served alongside the female soldiers. What did they tell you?
They were not just intensely committed to making sure that they got credit, but they would go with me in detail to talk about what real warriors they were. There was a moment in the story where one of the young women who we meet is going off to battle, and an American special operations soldier who has come of age in the post 9/11 wars. His entire adult life has been spent going back and forth to Iraq and Afghanistan, right? He's done 12, 13, 14 deployments. And he sees 30 young women on a flatbed truck, some with flowers in their hair, kind of hugging each other, all with their AKs, getting ready to fight ISIS at this meeting point. And he has this moment where he has awe at who they are as warriors. He has kind of shame because he wishes that U.S. policy would let him go so he could help them, because he has so much more experience at war than they did. And then he has just true respect for them as warriors. And he kind of flashes back to the 1963 MacArthur speech at West Point: duty, honor, country. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's who these women are. And, you know, one last point on that, in the last 24 hours, I've had two men from U.S. Special Operations write to me to say thank you for telling this story, because these women really deserve every bit of credit they can get.
Wow. And one thing I want to point out is that a number of these women actually rose to officer positions, and they weren't just commanding female units. They were actually leading men into battle as well. I wonder, how did the men react to serving under a woman?
And that is the opening of the book, right? Because you and I share same worldview. So we go in the opening of the book to the front line in Raqqa. This is in summer of 2017. It's like 170,000 degrees. I sweat through everything I'm wearing, you know, and we go to the front line, and my crew and I will say I was nervous, right? Because this is an ongoing fight. ISIS has just not wanting to give up its capital. And Clara, one of the commanders, is just walking around, no body armor, no nothing, right? Just a scarf on her head. And she's pointing to this still smoking car bomb that ISIS set off, targeting her and her forces. And she's like, can you believe that? Like, look at what they still do. And this is her commute to work every single day. And so to me, it was just like trying to show people the urgency and the immediacy of what they faced kind of every single moment in that fight against ISIS.
And now, this is not your first time reporting from a war zone, but I think that you went to northeastern Syria something like 7 times for this book. What did all that entail, traveling to this region in the Middle East in the middle of a civil war? What went into that, all the planning and the logistics?
I did. You know, it's a privilege to be able to go and for people to let you into their lives in some of the most heroic moments and also some of the most challenging. But I'll tell you, the thing that is remarkable about northeastern Syria is how normal it feels, truly. And so my husband always say, you know, complacency is your biggest enemy, because, you know, you're watching, you know, folks kind of go on with very normal lives in many towns, and then you hit the front line. So it's really a place where there is both the absolute best of humanity and the absolute worst of humanity right up against each other. And I think it was the nobility of the human spirit that I so wanted to capture for readers. Yeah. And you know, there's in Kobani now you go and there's like what they call the Champs-Élysées, where you go shopping. And I almost bought pink glittering tennis shoes for my daughter, but the store was closed. So, I mean, I think you'd be amazed by just, you know, how much very fragile normalcy that these women fought for is now in place all across northeastern Syria.
Now, you mentioned your daughter, and you talk in the book about how you didn't intend to go off to Syria and write this book. You thought that you'd be planting roots for a while and spending more time at home with your family. What goes through your mind when you take on a project like this and decide to put yourself in harm's way? Do you find yourself planning for the worst and wondering what's going to happen to your kids if you don't come back? I mean, as a parent, I can't imagine what that's like.
So, you know, my mom passed when I was 13. And I think I always had this sense of life having to matter. If you have the privilege of being on this earth, as my mother always said, you know, you must make what you do count.
Wow. Yeah.
And my kids, I want them to grow up in a world where people can rewrite the rules that govern their lives that other people put in place for them. I want them to know that a world in which women lead does look different. I want them to know that history can't be forgotten just because women are part of it. I want them to know that a world in which everybody has a voice, in which justice is part of it, in which people from different faiths and different ethnic groups live together as these women were fighting for, that stands for something. And that I want them to know that there are people who truly believe that having a purpose is what gets you up in the morning and what puts you to bed each night. And if I have the privilege of being able to bring some of that back so that I can join amazing shows like this one and share it with your listeners, then, you know, to me, that's a blessing. It's a privilege.
Yeah, well put. I imagine, though, that you must have worried about your safety the entire time you were there. Can you recall a particularly dangerous moment or a time when you weren't sure that you might make it back?
I mean, really, I only had one, and that was from the front line. And I know that sounds surprising, really? But I think it's a testament to the success of the women and the men who are part of this story, right? Mm-hmm. When they took towns back from ISIS, it was all locally led. So you would, at every checkpoint, there's a scene at the end of the book, at the opening of the Raqqa Women's Council. In the summer of 2018, I go to this women's group event. And I go in so cynical and so American, right? Like, oh, this is going to be a dog and pony show for the foreigners. And
right.
I show up there with my amazing team. Mustafa is my colleague. And we go there. Again, it's literally like 112 degrees or something like that. And so we stand in this courtyard. And then I realize, first of all, there are no foreigners. There are no Americans protecting the event. It's all the people that we meet in the book protecting their own events, right? You don't see anybody from the international community standing around or joining. And there are just women and men dancing and singing and celebrating the opening of a place that's going to be advocating for women and girls on the same streets where genuinely just months earlier, men of ISIS had bought and sold women.
Wow.
And I think it's that kind of stuff that really stayed with me.
I wonder, was it hard to get some of these women to open up to you? I mean, they're in the middle of a war fighting for their lives. Was it hard to get them to put down their weapons and talk to you about it?
Yes. I mean, and they really thought it was, you know, not funny, but kind of absurd. They were like, Gail, really? How many interviews are you going to make me do? Because book interviews are particularly tedious, right? You have to go back over the same thing. So, yeah. So when this person shot at you, were you on this side of the building or were you on this side of the building? And, you know, by 3 hours in, you just want out. Gail, like, war, you know, going back to training looks like, you know, much a better option than sitting there for another 30 minutes. And none of them thought they'd done anything exceptional.
No kidding.
And they only, right. And they only talked to me basically because their boss said they had to, and because they liked me, and because I would joke with them, come on, you know, you know, 20 years from now, you want somebody to know this happened. And Rojda, even there's a moment at the end of, she's leading the battle for Raqqa. She's working with the Americans every day, and CNN gets in her face at the very end, you know, just puts a camera, you know, how do you feel? You finally, Raqqa is cleared. She says, I feel very good. I'm very proud that we've done this for humanity. And I'm really glad I don't have to see you all anymore. because she doesn't want to deal with the press anymore. So yes,
right.
They would always grudgingly do the interview, but always be incredibly gracious about it.
Now, having defeated ISIS, you describe how these women are now working on building their own, as you call it, a feminist utopia in the most unlikely of places, frankly. What are some of the changes that they're proposing or enacting now?
It is remarkable because the military peace was only a means to an end to change their politics, right? And as Nauru said to me once, if we lead in battle, nobody will question whether we can govern in peace. And that's true. So they, and the book really chronicles this, along the military fight and the political battles are happening simultaneously. And they go to every draft constitution meeting and say, we need to include women have equal rights. All girls have rights to education, no child marriage, no dowry, right? All of these things that are pretty radical. Women's guaranteed political representation, women judges hearing women's cases, right? Things we don't do here.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like they're pushing reforms that would be progressive and maybe even radical by our own standards here in the U.S. That's amazing.
That struck me all the time, honestly. Yeah. And really, some of the people who influenced their ideology, one of them is a gentleman named Murray Bookchin sitting in Vermont, who wrote about grassroots participatory democracy with environmental consciousness right at the center.
Really?
In the 1960s, right? Well ahead of his time. And these ideas meet the idea of women's equality and they get put into place in northeastern Syria and get catapulted onto the global stage by the U.S.
I wonder, are they working to spread equal rights for women beyond Syria's borders into other countries in the Middle East?
It's interesting. The first time I interviewed in the summer of 2017, when we're there at the opening of the book, I interview one of the women who's been fighting ISIS all day. And she says, we are writing our own history now. We are not just doing this for women in Syria or for northeastern Syria, but for women across the region and around the world. And I asked the dumb question because my father comes from the region. I said, but why start in the Middle East? It's so, you're really starting in the hardest place. And
right.
she looks at me, not exactly
low-hanging fruit.
Exactly, right? And she looks at me like, with the look that says, you've just asked a really stupid question, and looks at me and says, we know, we're from here. And if we can do it here, then there's no place we won't be able to show what women are capable of.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned earlier that the U.S. was looking for a partner in Syria who wasn't fighting Assad. I'm curious, what is their opinion of the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad? I mean, he arguably has just as much blood on his hands as the Islamic State.
100%. And I think for them, it was about an ethnic minority that had long struggled for survival, that its older generation wasn't looking for problems, right? Okay. So we entered the story in 2004, there's a scuffle, which becomes a real conflagration. And the Assad regime shoots at unarmed protesters from the Kurdish community. And thousands end up being jailed afterward by the Syrian regime. Almost every leader in the book was either jailed or tortured by the Syrian regime. But the issue is they don't know what comes next. So if you're not sure, and this is what the book, in their view, right? That if you can't be sure that whomever comes after Assad won't be worse, then you have to be very, very careful. And what they were seeking was self-rule. And that's what they were putting in place, where they could, you know, speak their language, publish in their language, rule their own institutions for the first time in history. And that's what they did the minute that the vacuum of the Syrian civil war let them rule themselves.
Now, right now, America has a limited presence in Syria after Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops from northern Syria. Depending on what the new administration decides, what's at stake for the women of Kobani?
I think what's at stake for the women of Kobani is honestly and truly what's at stake for the United States, right? Which is who is going to keep the pressure on the Islamic State and who is America's partner in doing so and in keeping the front lines of extremism a place that we understand who's where and can understand how to contain that threat. Mm-hmm. Right now, everything hangs in a very fragile balance because this experiment in governance that has been created on the back of the military victories against ISIS with the U.S. As the U.S. partner is still in place. And they are still fighting each day to keep it so. And the Biden administration will soon have a moment when it decides whether and how it's going to continue working with this partner. Right now, America is kind of the Oz-like presence that hangs over the area. You never see it, but you know it's there. And it lets these folks, these women, you know, Nowruz and Azima and Roja, these people we get to know, lets their forces continue to protect what they've built. But a decision as to how and whether to continue that is up right up ahead.
I was interested to read that our NATO ally, Turkey, actually considers the YJP terrorists. Can you explain the reasoning behind that?
That's correct. And, you know, the book kind of takes people into explaining some of the complexity behind this. For Turkey, Abdullah Öcalan, who is their leader, who founded the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, to basically advocate for Kurdish rights inside Turkey. They make no distinction because Turkey very much sees that as a terrorist group. It had launched attacks inside Turkey through time, and Turkey saw it as the enemy. Then comes the Americans working with the Syrian Kurds, who are not the same as the PKK, but are an offshoot of that group. And Turkey says, this is a bigger existential threat to us than ISIS. And the Americans say two things. One, the Syrian Kurds, these folks are not launching any attacks against Turkey or any other NATO ally. What they're doing is fighting terrorists for us, with us, and for the world. And number two, we're your NATO ally. We will help make sure that everybody stays on side. But for Turkey, and this becomes a theme that runs through the entire book, this high wire act that the Obama administration and then the Trump administration walks between addressing these concerns.
Mm-hmm. What was the reaction from these misogynistic monsters in ISIS when they found out that they were not just fighting against women, but in fact getting their asses handed to them by them?
Yeah, I mean, and there's a moment. So at the beginning, as Azima told me one time, at the beginning, and we follow this in the book, the ISIS guys get on the radio and they're like, try to pick off the women, you know, make sure you get the women first. And later, like a couple of weeks later in Kobani, they're on the radio because they can all hear each other all the time. They get on the radio and they say, hey, be careful of those women snipers. They're very tricky. And she took that as a huge compliment. And I think that I wanted to capture that connectivity, right? Like they really knew who these men were that they were fighting. ISIS guys would get on the radio and say, we're going to come enslave you. We're going to come get you. And they would have restraint. But the younger people who worked for them, for these women, would get on and be like, yeah, you're such a man, you know, come out and show it, and would try to defeat them that way.
I understand that Hillary and Chelsea Clinton have recently optioned the television rights to the Daughters of Kobani. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yes, and truly, I want everyone to get to know this story. I want all of us to meet these women and spend time with them. And I'm so excited to bring to screen, with the help of creators from really around the region and around the world, this story of women who said enough.
Before we go, there's a great quote by you that really resonated with me. And I think it applies not just to this situation, but also to geopolitics more broadly. You say, suffocated opportunity is the enemy of global stability. What should be the role of America in fostering opportunity both at home and abroad as the antidote to extremism?
This is the theme that preoccupies every story I've had the privilege of telling, that suffocated opportunity is the enemy of global stability. And what taught me that was meeting girls forced to marry at age 12, girls deprived of education who would have been bright lights, maybe the next Steve Jobs, maybe the next Maya Angelou. And realizing that this is our work. We have no talent to waste in a world that needs the contributions and the economic fortitude of all of our members, not just half, and not just a limited few in the elites. And I think the United States has such a unique role in untapping and in really uncorking the potential of people all around the world who might not look the same as the people who've long held power, but who can make huge contributions to an economy and to an international community that needs every bit of talent it has.
Yeah, well said, well said. And this is just a truly unbelievable story. I absolutely loved it. I really encourage people to read it. Once again, the book is called The Daughters of Kobani, A Story of Rebellion, Courage, and Justice. Gail Samak Limon, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Gail Samak Limon for coming on the podcast. Order Gail's new book, The Daughters of Kobani, A Story of Rebellion, Courage, and Justice, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Keep up with Gail at gaillimon.com or on Twitter at Gail Limon. That's Gail Limon, spelled like lemon, L-E-M-M-O-N. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.